so unhappy. I must stay strong for them.
I understand, I said.
And one mustn't dwell on sadness, she said. As father's friend would say, a stiff upper lip, don't you know?
She mimicked well an English accent. We exchanged a smile and then returned to the game. Under an hour later, as I was preparing to leave, word came that Bill Thomas was waiting outside to see me. My heart racing, I headed to the stairway where I ran into Suki. She reached out as though she wanted to say something, but I didn't want to keep Thomas waiting and shook my head.
Later,
I whispered and left. The man was standing in the shade of the house, one foot resting casually on a back step. Mr. Thomas, I greeted him as cheerfully as I could. It is good to see you again. He nodded in response, then took off his hat, wiped his forehead with his sleeve, and ran a hand through his thick blonde hair. He replaced his hat, then studied me while setting it right. Are you ready to do business? I asked. He looked down at his feet. What kind of business you wantin' to do? He leaned over and slapped at some dust on his pant leg. I knew that I had one chance. I'll get right to the point. I want to buy that woman Suki and the boy Pan. I'll give you what you ask. Afraid you wantin' two that's not for sale. I have a few others you can have a look at. He eyed me with a smile. From the upstairs room, I heard Addie call out for Hester and wondered if Thomas knew that Hester and Suki were likely at the open window, listening to our conversation. It is the two from the hospital that I am wanting, I said.
They ain't for sale.
Name the amount, I said.
They are not for sale, he said.
All right, then I'll settle on Pan.
Nope, not for sale.
And what if I were to tell you that he was stolen from me? If I expected a surprised reaction, it was not forthcoming. He remained as composed as ever.
And you have papers on him? He asked.
He was free. He didn't have papers.
So you say, he smirked.
Look, I said, anger seeping in. If you don't sell him now, I will return with papers that say he is free, and then you'll get nothing for him. Why not just sell him to me, and that will put an end to all of this?
Why you wantin' him so bad? Seems you got some other kind of interest in him. You get yourself with a nigra? He your boy?
I glared at him, and when his blue eyes glinted with pleasure, I realized I had lost. Nothing material would substitute for the deep satisfaction that his power provided him. Threats were all I had left. Unless you sell him now, I make a promise that I shall keep. Stealing Negro children from Philadelphia is illegal, and if you do not hand him over to me now, I will prosecute you. I will not stop until I see you.
I've heard enough. The boy's already sold.
I took a step back to stare at him.
So he is no longer here?
Traders coming by to pick him up.
You've actually sold him? I asked, moving closer again.
That's right, he said.
Once he's gone, I'll forget I ever saw him. Funny thing is, everybody on this place is gonna forget about him too. You come back here with those papers, nobody's gonna know who you're talking about.
An armed overseer, fingering his gun, watched from a nearby position. Thomas scanned the fields. Finally, he looked back at me.
I take it, then, you don't have no interest in any of the others?
You know who I want.
Something tells me you didn't come here just for that boy. What I'd like to know is what you're doing here anyway. When you started asking for Suki now, that got my attention. Why her?
He peered out from under the brim of his hat.
Something's just not sitting right. I've got to tell you, as soon as you came over here looking for that boy, I've been wondering if you're actually from Philadelphia. I got a man in town looking into you right now. From the start, something about you don't feel right to me.
Casually, he placed his hand on top of the gun slung from his waist.
Now, Mr. Philadelphia, you got time to get your horse, and you got time to get up on him. Then I'll give you enough time to ride out. But I'm warning you right now. Don't come back.
I had no weapon, and even if I had, I was outnumbered. My chest pounded with impotent rage as I walked down the brick path that led me out of the garden and past the hospital. Was Pan still there? Or had they already taken him? I spurred my horse for home and pounded into Mr. Spencer's yard, where he and Sam were standing outside the barn. Fury had me lose good sense. "Thomas already sold the boy," I shouted, "and he told me to get off the property." The two stared up at me. "The boy was mine," I continued to shout. "Months ago, he was stolen from me. He was free, but he was under my care." Mr. Spencer looked grim. "I was beginning to wonder about your interest in the boy," he said, then turned to Sam. "Hitch up the farm wagon. We've got to get over there." He hurried toward the house and waved me with him. "Help me get the wagon fitted so we can fetch Addie." I didn't understand his need to remove his daughter. Surely Thomas would not harm the girl. "He was upset, but he won't involve Addie," I said as we pulled pallets, pillows, and blankets from the house and heaped them into the wagon to create a soft nest in which to cradle the patient. "I've seen Thomas when he's riled. He takes it out on others, and I don't want her on the place if that starts to happen." When we finished, Mr. Spencer climbed up on the wagon alongside Sam. "Do you want me to come?" I offered, but Mr. Spencer gave me a grim look. "You stay here, and when I get back, we'll talk this through. Right now, I've got to get over there." Sam slapped the reins and set the two horses off at a trot. Before they were out of sight, I went into the house to begin packing. With Thomas's men asking questions about me in town, I had to leave as soon as possible. With a sick heart, I realized that I would have to leave Pan behind. Chapter 37 1830 James Addie waved to us with her good arm as the wagon rolled up to where Patricia, Clara, and I waited on the front steps. Sam pulled the team to a stop, and Mr. Spencer leaped down with more agility than I had seen previously. As he made his way back for Addie, the pounding of hooves and then a stream of dust alerted us to two approaching riders. One of the horses, a dark brown gelding, galloped forward and was brought to an abrupt halt in front of the wagon. From atop the horse, Bill Thomas glared down at Mr. Spencer. "I'm missing the boy," he shouted. "They're telling me he's gone." I stared, disbelieving. "And which boy is that?" Mr. Spencer sounded as angry as I'd ever heard him. Thomas looked over at me. "Should I be asking you?" My look of surprise was genuine. "I have no idea what you are talking about." "That boy, Pan," he said. "What do you know about him running off?" I had the horrifying thought that if Pan had escaped, he might have come looking for me. Was he hiding somewhere on this property? "I know nothing," I said as calmly as I could. "I thought you said he was sold." The other rider spoke up.
"He was meant for me. I just come for him."
Thomas swung himself off his horse.
"I don't suppose you'd mind if we have a look around."
Mr. Spencer turned red in fury.
"You doubt my word? Go on. Take a look through the barns, and while you're at it, you may as well search the house."
He turned to me. "Mr. Burton, do you object to this man going through your room?"
"Not in the least," I said.
But was this wise? Was it possible Pan had found his way into the house? "Then, Mr. Burton, I ask you to accompany Mr. Thomas to see that everything is left as he found it. I will wait out here with my family." Mr. Spencer turned back to Addie. "It's all right, dear. As soon as this invasion is over, we'll get you in the house." The trader, accompanied by Sam, went to search the barns. When Thomas climbed the steps to the house, I followed while Mr. Spencer shouted after us.
"Thomas, I'll tell you now, you have one chance to do this. You insult me with this accusation. I am not a thief and neither is my guest. This one time you have my permission for access to my property, but I warn you, it will not happen again."
I led Thomas through the house. And each time he peered under a bed or opened a cupboard, my heart hammered. But Pan was not found. And Thomas's fury was palpable when we left the house. I stood next to him on the porch as he surveyed the property, and my eyes followed his when they rested on the wagon. Adelaide was propped up with pillows and quilts and looked quite comfortable. But when Thomas suddenly jumped off the front porch and strode toward the wagon, she grabbed hold of her arm and stiffened. Hester had already stepped down and stood next to Clara and Patricia, but on Thomas's swift approach, she clutched the girls to her. When I moved forward, Mr. Spencer stopped me with a glance and a quick shake of his head. Thomas reached the wagon and began to yank at one of the quilts. Addie's shrieks were so piercing that he stepped back.
"Daddy! Daddy! He's hurting my arm! He's hurting my arm!"
Mr. Spencer clapped his hand on Thomas's shoulder.
"You will not hurt my daughter!"
His voice was so dangerous that I did not recognize it.
"You have accused me of thievery. You have searched my house and you have insulted my guest, but you will not assault my daughter. She is ill and I will harm you if you do not leave at once."
Addie's wrenching sobs filled the air.
"My arm, Daddy, my arm! Make him go away, Daddy! He's hurt my arm!"
When Patty began to screech for her sister, Thomas moved away, but he shot me a last look before mounting his horse. Addie's cries continued as the two rode away, though they quickly ceased when the riders were no longer in sight. Patricia, concerned for her sister, began to climb into the wagon. Mr. Spencer caught her by her waist and set her down beside Clara.
"Hester, I need you to take Clara and Patty up to Addie's room and wait for us there. Make certain the girls stay with you. I might have to carry Addie up, and I don't want to trip over anyone."
Addie exhaled after Hester quickly ushered the two young girls away.
"Oh, Daddy," she said, her face blotched pink from crying.
"You were brave, my dear. Very brave," her father said. "But now let's get you into the house."
I came forward to help just as Addie moved her feet to the side and pulled back the pink and green quilt.
"Are you all right?"
she whispered, looking down into the wide eyes of a frightened boy. I stared at Pan in disbelief. I was about to shout my relief when Mr. Spencer barked out,
"Cover him up!"
And Pan ducked under the covers once again.
"Boy, can you hear me?"
he asked. A muffled "uh-huh" answered him.
"Listen to me," Mr. Spencer said.
"First, we will get Miss Addie into the house. You stay right where you are, and we will drive the wagon into the barn. Later, we'll roll you up in blankets and bring you into the house. You hear me?"
The "uh-huh" was barely perceptible. I could have wept in relief at knowing Pan was with us. As we helped Addie from the wagon, she looked at me and gave a thin laugh.
"Oh, Mr. Burton, I was so frightened for the poor boy. My legs still feel weak," she said.
"I don't wonder," I said, offering her a grateful smile. What bravery she and her father had shown. But why had they risked so much? What was Pan to them? Yet now was not the time to ask.
"Do you want me to go to the barn with the wagon?" I asked Mr. Spencer.
"No, I'll go with Sam. It's best that you go inside. Can you take Addie in? Hester is waiting for her in her room. The two younger girls know nothing about this," he warned.
"I understand," I said before offering Addie my arm and leading her into the house. She sighed when we came to the inside stairway.
"I don't know if I am strong enough to climb all of those stairs, Mr. Burton. I believe I might be too weak."
"Miss Adelaide, do I have your permission to carry you?" I asked.
"You do,"
she said. And when I scooped her up, she dropped her head against my shoulder. Her hand rested softly against my chest.
"This is really quite romantic," she said, sighing again.
And in spite of the trauma of the day, I fought back a chuckle.
"Well, today you are a heroine," I said.
"Do you think so, Mr. Burton?"
she asked as I carried her to her room.
"Indeed I do," I said.
The patient was welcomed into her room with great fanfare. As Hester settled her on her bed, Addie pulled her down to whisper in her ear.
"Did I do well, Hester?"
Hester smoothed Addie's hair back from her face while giving her a soft look.
"You did real good, Miss Addie. You did just like your own mama would have done."
Patty stood back, nervously observing her older sister.
"Did he hurt you?"
she asked.
"It sounded like he hurt you." "Come here, dearest,"
Addie said to her, tapping the bed.
"Come here beside me. I've missed you, Patty Pat."
When Patricia burst into tears and ran to her, I left them to Hester. Downstairs, I met Mr. Spencer on the way to his study. He motioned for me to follow, and once there, he poured each of us a double measure of whiskey. He tossed his down and I followed suit, welcoming the hot surge.
"Sit," Mr. Spencer commanded as he removed a pistol from the interior of his jacket and set it on his desk. But I remained standing, anxious to see Pan.
"Do you want me to bring the boy in?" I asked.
"No," he said, pointing to a chair as he took a seat. "At this moment, he's as safe in the barn as he is in here. But we need to get him away from this property as soon as possible."
"I'll leave with him tonight. We'll go down to Edenton and sail out from there," I said.
"No, they'll be watching for the two of you. Thomas will have his men all over the place. You must remain here at least for a few days after the boy leaves. That way you'll avoid suspicion. The boy will stay here tonight, but by tomorrow we'll have to get him up to Norfolk."
"How will we do that?" I asked.
"I have my ways," he said. I studied the man I thought I had known. Why would he risk his life and his family's safety for a young Negro? After all, he was a slave owner himself. I had to ask.
"Why are you..."
He anticipated my question. "Look, I believe in minding my own business, but there are times when one can't look the other way. Weeks ago, after the boy first arrived, Suki sent word to Hester about getting him out. She had taken a liking to him and was afraid of what Thomas would do to him. This morning, after Suki heard the traitor was coming today, she hid the boy. Fortunately, Thomas didn't think we were coming for Addie until tomorrow, and he was out in the field, so after we got Addie settled in the wagon, we stopped at the barns where the boy was hidden. So that's why Suki kept trying to tell me to get him out.
If Thomas ever finds out how many that woman has..."
He stopped himself, then looked me in the eye. "I have told you more than might be wise. Now you must tell me what your interest is in this boy."
"I would be happy to tell you everything, but might we first get Pan into my room?"
"As you wish," he agreed and heaved himself up from the chair. We found the frightened boy in the safety of the barn, still hidden under quilts in the wagon. I kept him wrapped when I scooped him up, as though carrying a bundle of quilts down to my room. Free of the blankets, the boy was wet with perspiration. When I had him remove his clothes in exchange for a dry nightshirt of mine, I was shocked to see how frail he looked. Hester brought some bread and cheese. Pan refused the food but greedily drained a mug of milk. I took the empty cup from his quivering hand.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Burton," he said, "but I can't make myself stop shaking."
"That's all right," I said. "That can happen when you've had a fright." I had him climb into the bed and pull the covers up around himself.
"I was so scared," he said. "I thought you'd go without me."
"Don't you worry," I said, trying to insert conviction. "We're gonna get you home safe." He studied me with sunken eyes but managed to smile. How unlike he was from the carefree boy I had known. I had to tell him about his father, but now was not the time. "You rest," I said, and left then for the study where Mr. Spencer awaited me. He was seated in his worn armchair and lifted a glass toward me. "Pour another for yourself," he invited, but I declined as I took a seat. Now more than ever, I needed clarity. How much should I tell this man? And what was he about? Not certain where to begin, I looked around to give myself time. The room was comfortable enough, but not furnished in a lavish way. There were a few good pieces, a highboy to the side, and a red settee that showed age. A stack of books that appeared to be accounting records rather than literary works rested on a large but simple oak desk. The windows were covered by green wooden shades, tilted open to allow in an early evening breeze. One of them rattled, startling me. Quickly, I glanced toward it, but reassured that it was only a breeze, I turned back to my host. "Mr. Spencer, let me begin by apologizing for my deceit. My true purpose down here was to find Pan. A few months ago, he was stolen from my employ in Philadelphia and brought down here and where he was sold to Thomas. Pan's father, a man to whom I was deeply indebted, was once a slave himself, and somehow he was able to locate his son at Southwood. How he discovered this, I have no idea." Mr. Spencer nodded. "They have their ways."
"Yes, apparently so.
My trip to these parts had already been scheduled,
I was given a grant by the museum to do a study of birds. That part is true. Though before I left, the money was withdrawn. But I had made a promise to Pan's father that I would find the boy and bring him back. I took a deep breath. So here I am. I apologize again for all of the untruths, but until today I was uncertain of your views. I can't say I like to be lied to, but under the circumstances... Mr. Spencer paused and my conscience pricked. Should I tell him more? Should I mention my connection to Suki? Did I need to? No, I had said enough. Divulging more would serve no purpose. Now that I have the boy, I would like to leave with him immediately. I must get to Williamsburg, where my daughter awaits. Yet you think that unwise? I asked. There's no way you could leave this property with the boy and not be discovered. Like I said earlier, you've got to sit tight for a few days until we get the boy out. That's going to be hard enough. Chances are Thomas has already called in Rankin. My heart thudded. Was it possible? Rankin? I asked. He's a tracker out of Virginia, well known in these parts for finding runaways. He's mean as a skunk and deadly, too, known to bring back only body parts just so he gets paid. I was finding it hard to breathe. Should we call in the law? I asked. Surely Thomas is not above the law. The minute we bring the law into this, Thomas will lay claim to the boy. Before you have the legalities worked out, he will have the boy either dead or shipped out. He took a long swallow of his drink. I fought rising panic. What do we do? I asked. No doubt Thomas will have this place watched. Fortunately, with Addie's arm as an excuse, I can send for old Doc McDougal. He and his man have a wagon that is outfitted for situations such as this. It's damned uncomfortable for a grown man or woman, but your boy should fit in with no problem. I've already sent word, and with any luck, Doc will be here by the morning. We'll have to get the boy back into the barn before daylight. And where will this man take him? Old Doc lives close up by the Great Dismal. He has people there who will pick the boy up, then get him on board a ship, and send him back up to Philadelphia. How about Williamsburg? Can they send him on there? Is that where you're heading? Yes, my sister lives in Williamsburg, and I will send Pan to her. I have money for his passage, I added. Good, that always helps, he said, then nodded toward his desk. Could you write down your sister's name? I did so with some reluctance, for I had no idea how another imposition would be received by Miss Ellie. I wrote down Robert's name as well. He is my valet and the one to get in touch with. He will care for the boy until I get there. Robert is the most trustworthy man I know. I understand, said Mr. Spencer. Sam is the one I would trust with my life. I stood. I think that I will try to get some sleep, I said, and went toward the door, then turned back. I can't thank you enough for your understanding and your help. My host nodded. Let the boy rest. Then get him back out to the barn before daybreak. Sam will be waiting for him. Pan was asleep when I arrived back in my room. Not wanting to disturb him, I sat in a chair and dozed until later that night, when Mr. Spencer alerted us that it was time for Pan to return to the barn. As the boy dressed, I told him of the plan for his escape. Not wishing to burden him further, I decided not to tell him of his father's death.
I wish you'd come with me, Pan said plaintively.
You're gonna have to be brave, I said.
I'm scared, he said.
I know. I was only a year older than you when I set out for Philadelphia all on my own. I was afraid too, but I was determined to be a strong man. And now look at me. I postured for him, puffing out my chest and flexing my arms until he smiled. It was true, I had been his age, but I had been in robust health and he was far from it. Pan was close to tears when I left him in the barn with Sam. It pained me to see his distress, so I turned to leave quickly.
Mr. Burton! Mr. Burton!
He called out in a loud whisper. Yes, Pan?
Don't worry, Mr. Burton. I'll be strong, just like you.
He puffed out his small chest and flexed his thin arms. I couldn't trust myself to speak.
so I just waved back.
Chapter 38 1830 James. Doc McDougal was a thin, stooped old man who appeared to have a difficult time getting down from his wagon. Warmly received by Mr. Spencer, the old man removed his worn hat from atop a mane of long white hair before he nodded in my direction. After our brief introduction, he straightened himself as much as his body would allow, then slowly took the stairs to find Addie, leaving me to wonder how this arthritic old man could help Pan escape. I did as Mr. Spencer said and stayed indoors while he got Pan settled in the doctor's wagon. I paced until Doc's return downstairs, where he found me in the study. The old man went to the sideboard and helped himself to a sizable portion of whiskey, then looked me over as he drank it. He set the empty glass down with a thump.
"Mind if I ask why you come all the way down here for him?" he asked.
"I promised his father I would find him," I said. He grunted.
"You best take care. Thomas is gonna have it out for you. By now he's got to know that you're involved."
"Thank you for the warning," I said. "I plan to leave by tomorrow."
"I wouldn't do that. Sit tight for another week or two. Let Thomas's suspicions die down."
I already knew I wouldn't do as he suggested. By tomorrow I plan to be in Edenton on the first coach out. "Can you tell me where you're taking the boy?" I asked.
"The less you know, the better. All's I can say for now is that we're gonna try to get him out of here in one piece. Spencer said the boy's got a place to go in Williamsburg?"
"He does," I said. I wanted to say more to thank this man, but he left abruptly, and soon after, his wagon rolled away. I watched from behind the slats of the window blinds and wondered how they managed to cram Pan into the hiding place under the wagon seat. I hated to think of how uncomfortable and frightened the boy must be, but I reminded myself that he was on his way to freedom. And tomorrow, in spite of Doc's warnings, I would leave too. As I watched the dust from the wagon settle on the empty road, Clara called me from the head of the stairs.
"Mr. Burton, Miss Addie wanting to see you."
I found Adelaide propped up in her bed, with Patricia and Clara on either side, eager to serve her. Although the patient was smiling, her face was drawn, and she soon sent the two other girls off on a chore.
"Has the wagon left?"
she asked as soon as we were alone.
"Yes," I said. "A few minutes ago."
"Oh, good," she sighed. "Doc McDougal is such a fine man, don't you think?"
"I do," I said. "He is a family friend?"
"He and my grandfather grew up together," she said. "Daddy knew him when he was a little boy. Now he and Daddy often work together."
She looked at me from under her lashes. Where before I would have thought she was playing at being coy, now I saw she was trying to read me.
"I see," I said. "And you help them as well?"
"Mr. Burton, I've been told," she said, looking at me sideways. "The less said, the better."
"Of course," I smiled. "And we must respect that.
Unless you have a question that I feel obliged to answer."
She raised her eyebrows.
"Miss Adelaide," I chuckled and shook my head. "You are a prize.
After I leave, you must promise to write to me, and you must not stop those letters until after you are safely married. I can only imagine the havoc you will wreak and the hearts you will break. Your letters will be more intriguing than any novel."
"Indeed,"
she agreed, giving a sly smile. But I sensed that underneath her facade she was as worried about the safety of Pan as I was. Our concerns were justified. In under 2 hours, Doc McDougal's carriage returned. When Mr. Spencer rushed out, he found Doc slumped to the side with chest pain severe enough that he could not continue on. Mr. Spencer and I helped the old man into the study while Sam drove the carriage into the barn.
"Give me a stiff one," Doc directed Mr. Spencer.
The old man downed the whiskey, then held out his glass again. But before it could be refilled, Doc slid to the floor. For a long moment, Mr. Spencer and I stared in disbelief, and though we were soon on our knees beside him, the old man was already gone.
An hour or so later, a shaken Mr. Spencer laid out his plan to me. He would take Doc's body to his son's home some 2 hours away. "The boy will have to stay hidden in the barn," he said. "I'll try to make it back here before sunrise. Then I might have to drive him out myself." The strain had drained all healthy color from his face. "Is that the only option?" I asked.
"I need some time to think it through," he said. "But I'll have it figured out by the time I return. Meanwhile, you stay inside this house. Don't go out to see the boy, and whatever you do, don't bring him in with you. It's too dangerous."
He handed over a pistol.
"Keep this on you," he said. "If there are intruders, use it. Sam will be on the lookout in the barn, and he is armed as well."
When the wagon left, there was some relief in knowing that Pan was not on it. Though dark clouds were gathering, it was so beastly hot that I doubted the boy could have survived the heat under the wagon seat. Alone in the study, I paced, desperately trying to think of a way out. I hated that I had put Mr. Spencer in the middle of this dangerous mess. Might it be best if I just took Pan and left? But where would we go? And how would we get there?
It was raining heavily by nightfall when Hester and I secured the house. She took Clara upstairs to stay the night with the girls, but I was too restless to sleep, so I went to the study. I wanted nothing more than to reassure Pan, but I had given my word to stay away from the barn. I thought to distract myself with a book, but I could not settle myself. My thoughts flew between concern for Pan and then for myself. Had Thomas already sent for Rankin? Would Thomas's description of my eye patch alert him? How long would it take for him to come here looking for me? Finally, I took the lamp and went to my bedroom, but there, too, I moved about restlessly, fingering my things while trying to decide if I should begin to pack. A loud clap of thunder and a bright flash of lightning lit up the room as I unlocked and lifted the lid of my trunk. There, at the bottom, I saw again the old jacket that hid my grandmother's jewels. I lifted it out and felt at the bulges, wondering if it wouldn't be safer to take the jewels out and secure them in a small money pouch. I found my silver apple corer in my traveling case, thinking that the sharp edge of the small knife would work well for opening the stitches, then sat on the edge of the bed. Just as I was about to slit open the first stitch, there came a rap on the door. Thinking it was Hester, I set the jacket aside, but when I opened the door, I found no one there. I stepped out into the dark hallway and looked about, but still saw nothing. Back inside, I convinced myself that it was a noise from the storm. But when I sat again to pick up the knife and jacket, another, more urgent rap came, quickly followed by another and then another. Then I realized my mistake. The persistent knocking was coming not from the interior door, but from the door that opened to the outside. I slipped the knife into the pocket of the old jacket and tossed it on the bed, then grabbed hold of the pistol from atop the dresser. The knocking grew more insistent, and after a short hesitation, I pointed my pistol forward and swung open the door. It took me a moment, between the heavy rain and the dim lamplight, to recognize Suki. She pushed in and slammed the door shut behind her. She waved her trembling hands in the air, indicating that she needed paper to communicate.
"We got to go now," she wrote. "They find out it was me who got Pan out. Traitor come in saying that Jake see you in Norfolk and tell Thomas that you a nigga. Patrollers getting together, but Thomas all fired up and send for Rankin."
She kept clutching at my arm and trying to pull me toward the door, making it difficult to read what she had written. But when I made out the words, I went numb with terror. As Suki frantically tugged on me, I stood rooted in fear. Where could I hide? Then I thought of the barn. "Sam is armed," I said. "We can hide out in the barn." Suki shook her head vehemently as she scribbled.
"They think nothing of killing him. We gotta get to the swamp."
Again she pulled on my arm, but I yanked my arm away as I tried to gather my thoughts. What should I take? I flung the gun on the table and grabbed my small satchel. Frantically, I looked about, wondering how to best fill it. Seeing the jacket on the bed, I dropped the satchel and lifted the jacket, intending to lock it away in the trunk. As I was about to do so, the door flew open.
"You got to go. Patroller's coming," Sam hissed the words.
Suki left through the open door as though shot from a gun. Sam rushed in and pushed at my back.
"Go! Go!" he said.
Suddenly, I was running with only the jacket in hand. Through the rain, I saw Suki's form cutting across the open field, moving so fast that I had to push myself to catch up with her.
"Mr. Burton! Mr. Burton!"
The call for me came through the rain. Hearing Pan's anguish, I turned back to see his small figure coming at a run.
"Don't leave me! I'm coming with you! Wait for me, Mr. Burton!" he cried.
Suki was a distance ahead, but she too heard Pan's cry and stopped. I took hold of Pan's shoulders and shook him. "Go back. Mr. Spencer will get you out tomorrow in the wagon. It'll be safer for you that way. Go now." I tried to turn him around.
"No,"
the boy pleaded, grabbing hold of my wet shirt sleeves.
"Take me with you. I don't want to be alone. Don't leave me here. Please, Mr. Burton."
Suki came running toward us, uttering frantic, guttural sounds. Seeing her desperation, I grabbed Pan's hand and we sprinted after her when she lit out once again. We stayed low to the ground, racing through the storm that crashed around us. By the time I realized we were heading toward Southwood, I didn't know what to do but follow, hoping that Suki had a plan. She didn't stop to rest when we reached the safety of the bushes that defined the two farms, but picked up her pace as she ran down what appeared to be a deer path. We followed, Pan clinging to my hand, all three of us panting for air until we reached the backside of the Southwood quarters. There, a Negro man waited in the shadows. Suki and I both sank onto a fallen log, while Pan dropped to the ground. I had scarcely caught my breath when I realized I had left the gun behind. I was furious with myself, but it was too late to go back. The man rubbed Pan's bare feet with some strong-smelling grease, then had me remove my boots and replace them with some odorous deerskin slippers.
"Indians make these. It the bear grease that stink. Throw the dogs off."
He knelt and slipped a pair over Suki's bare feet, and as he did so, she arched her back. With a shock, I saw her advanced pregnancy. How had she run like that? Surely she couldn't hope to escape in that condition. The two of them exchanged a private look as he helped her to her feet.
"You gonna be all right?"
he asked her. She nodded.
"Keep using this," he said, handing her a package of bear grease.
He took her face in his hands.
"You members where to go?" he asked, looking deep into her eyes. "First get to that big barn with that weather vane on top. The man there get you going the right way."
She gave another nod, and after she grunted something unintelligible, he kissed both sides of her full face before gently pushing her away.
"Go on then. We got everything in place here to throw him off. We make sure you get a good start."
We moved quickly, this time along a tight path through brush and brambles. When Suki began to slow, I thought she might have lost her way, but after she found the trail that ran alongside the river, her speed picked up again. We moved faster still at the sound of dogs in the distance. I almost barreled into Pan when Suki stopped suddenly and pointed down toward the water. Pan clutched my arm.
"I can't swim," he whispered.
"Neither can I," I said.
"Suki!"
I whispered as loud as I dared, but she was already gone, sliding down the embankment to the river's edge. We dared not lose her and slid down the hill to find Suki alongside the river, tossing away branches to uncover a small wooden raft. The barking of the dogs grew closer as we pushed the raft to the water's edge. Suki waved for the two of us to get on the craft, then shoved us off before she heaved herself up. Pan, terrified, clung to the raft as Suki and I each grabbed a pole. My arms shook from the strain of the strong undertow, but we were close to the opposite riverbank when a lone hound shot out of the woods and began a wild bark. The answering howls from the pack were distant but bone-chilling. I jumped off the raft into the thigh-high water and reached for Pan, catching him by the waist of his pants. Suki, too, leaped off, then pushed the craft back out for the current to take hold of it. As it swiftly swept away, we slogged over to the riverbank and pulled ourselves up onto the land and into the dense undergrowth. We lay there, winded, scanning the other side of the river, where the lone dog continued to yowl. Suki grunted softly as she turned to her side, readjusting the pressure on her swollen stomach. I, too, felt pressure on my stomach and realized it was my old jacket. In the fray, I had stuffed it into the waist of my trousers. Though the answering call of the other dogs was receding when Suki again rose to her feet, Pan and I followed close behind. We traveled due north. Though the land was flat, it dipped and rolled to accommodate the numerous small streams we crossed on foot. When in water, Pan clung to the waist of my trousers. But when we traveled the dry land, he made a point to walk on his own, keeping pace with me and glancing up often, I suppose to gauge my mood. We rested only after a particularly difficult water crossing, and it was almost daybreak when we came upon what appeared to be a small forest. There, Suki kept us to the periphery of the dark woods. As the sky began to lighten, we could see the outline of some outbuildings and a white clapboard house. Suki pointed to a large barn topped by a weather vane, a large arrow encircled in metal and showing up dark black against the sky.
Quakers, she scratched into my palm, then motioned for us to follow her.
For the first time since our departure, I felt something akin to relief.
What'd she say?
Pan whispered.
Quakers,
I answered. He asked for no further explanation, and I didn't offer one. Naturally, I was familiar with Quakers and their anti-slavery views, but in my Philadelphia social circle, they were criticized for so plainly expressing their opinions. Now I could only hope that what I had heard of them was true. We slipped into the largest of the three barns and sank down behind a stall. It seemed we had only just settled when a woman came into the building. Her face was protected from the early morning sun by a wide-brimmed bonnet, while her brown dress and dark green apron were cut full enough to accommodate her pregnant abdomen. She went directly to a bin and scooped out some grain, separated it into two troughs, then went to a large barn door that opened to a pasture. Calling her cows by name, she encouraged them to enter and patted their rumps in greeting as they lumbered toward their stalls. After the Quaker woman settled herself to do the milking, Suki stood. Startled by the abrupt appearance of Suki's face over the partition, the woman gave a sharp cry of alarm, then covered her mouth with her hand. Suki looked down at me helplessly, apparently out of ideas on how to continue. I saw no way out and slowly, so as not to scare the woman further, rose to stand beside Suki. The woman gaped wordlessly.
I apologize, madam, I said. We did not wish to frighten you, but we need your help.
Still, she stared. We are being pursued as runaway slaves, I said, even now sickened at associating myself with the word. When Pan peeked over to see the Quaker woman, she lost her hesitation.
Come,
she said, and we followed her at a run into the house. She took us down a wide hallway and into a whitewashed parlor, smaller than another we had passed, but still substantial enough to hold a large fireplace, a tall case clock, and a good number of plain chairs suspended from wall pegs. While looking up, Suki tripped on the gray braided rug, and I caught her just before she fell onto the spinning wheel and the numerous baskets of unspun wool and cotton surrounding it. Bright light streamed in through the large uncovered window. Now I saw what Suki had been staring at on the ceiling. Above us hung an enormous quilt suspended by ropes and attached to a huge quilting frame. The Quaker woman moved quickly and from a basket withdrew a large metal ring that she secured into one of the wide floor planks. After grabbing hold of rope and attaching it to the floor ring, she worked a pulley until two wide floorboards creaked and lifted. When she urged us into the dark hole, I dropped down almost 3 feet. Then reached for Pan as Suki awkwardly slid down on her own. A faraway voice called out, and the three of us sank to the dirt floor as the boards were quickly lowered. The voice grew louder.
Lillian?
Mother? Our hostess called out.
Yes,
came the reply.
There are guests.
But Joel is not here,
the mother objected.
They have need, the daughter replied. And patrollers are sure to come.
Then a quilting party?
Their conversation was as efficient as their surroundings.
Yes,
Lillian agreed, and their footsteps receded.
It was dark in our dugout, but there was enough light from gaps in the floorboards to see that the space was wide enough to hold at least 4 adults.
How many had made their way to freedom by hiding out here? And why would Quakers risk their lives like this, I wondered. It wasn't long before the floorboards were raised again. We were relieved to see Lillian with some milk and bread as well as 3 pallets and a chamber pot. They would hide us, she said, until her husband felt it safe for us to leave. Cautioning us to silence, she quickly closed us in again. We ate wordlessly and rolled out our pallets. Soon both Pan and Suki fell into a deep sleep. I lay back as well, but sleep would not come. My mind raced, and the space closed in on me. I worked to regulate my breathing in an effort to fight panic. How had I come to this? And how would I find my way out? I looked at Pan. Asleep, he looked more helpless than ever. As sickly as he was, I wondered if he could survive this journey. Why hadn't he stayed back? He would have had a better chance that way. I was furious with myself for not refusing him. What if he were to die and this was all for naught? Bitterly, I thought of burying Henry and of the promise that had brought me to these circumstances. I glanced at Suki. When was her baby due? She was the one who knew the route, but her swollen abdomen suggested an imminent birth. What would happen to us then? Surely a newborn would put an end to our flight. I shut my eyes. Each fear raised another, but what overrode all of them was my most immediate concern. Where was Rankin? Was he already with the patrollers? I knew what would happen if I was found. I would be tried as a Negro for murdering a white man, and my fate would be sealed. I would be hanged. After hours of torment, it almost felt a relief when a shuffling commotion began above us. Chapter 39. 1830. James. The patroller's heavy feet woke Pan and Suki. We three held our breath as the gathered quilting party above us stitched on the lowered quilt while they greeted the intruders. Their friendly greetings were not returned. When the patrollers shushed everyone and stood to listen, the silence grew almost unbearable. Then a child cried and was joined by another. Soon after, the disgruntled patrollers left, though the women stayed on to stitch while their children settled to play at their feet. Hours later, all was silent, but that evening, after the clock bonged for the 10th hour, we were brought up from the underbelly of the house. We needed a stool to help Suki out, and while the husband frowned uncertainly at her pregnancy, there seemed no choice but to lead us away. The tall Quaker man strode forward, sure and direct on a path that he knew well. Both Pan and Suki stayed strong, and we traveled wordlessly for much of the night. Just before daybreak, the man stopped to leave us in the shelter of dense woods. He spoke low, going over our directions as he handed us a packet of bread and hard cheese. "Stay to the north," he pointed, "and stay alert," he needlessly added before bidding us good luck and farewell. We found our way through the woods, which opened to an orange sky and fields of cotton that stretched endlessly before us. We all gratefully sank to the ground. Within minutes, Pan was asleep beside me. Suki lay down, and though she was restless, to my relief she did not try to communicate. Finally, by mid-afternoon, after no sign of human life, I could no longer take the weight. Though we had been advised to stay hidden and to travel only at night, I had seen no one about through the day and thus decided it was safe to leave before nightfall. When Suki realized my plan, she shook her head in disagreement. But after Pan and I stepped out together, Suki reluctantly followed. The sun beat down as we moved through the cotton fields, crouching low to bypass the small farms set back on sloping hills. On occasion, we heard the bark of a dog. At the sound, we froze and dropped to the ground, only to rise and move again when reassured that no one was about. Pan was silent, but his energy remained high, while Suki's face glistened from the heat. Once or twice she stumbled, but I kept on, relentlessly moving us forward, mindful only of reaching safety. Our destination was north, where lay the Great Dismal Swamp. Once there, traveling the outskirts, we would come to a cross canal that cut east, a waterway we would follow inland for 10 miles, where it connected to the main canal. Along that canal, we had directions for a safe house where lived a friend of Doc McDougall. Even as the sun set, it was insufferably hot. I missed my hat, which, along with the gun, I had regrettably left back at the house. What I clung to was my old jacket, counting on the jewels, if necessary, to buy our way to Norfolk. We pushed on, resting in small patches of trees long enough to catch our breath, and by nightfall we had reached a dense pocket of green forest. I wavered, uneasy at the spongy feel of the soil. Uncertain, I looked to Suki. Are we in the swamp? I asked, but she shook her head. Seeing my hesitation, she pushed past me to take the lead, fighting through the vines and briars until she found a stream. There she dropped to her knees to drink, and after Pan and I did the same, Suki broke off chunks of bread and cheese and we all ate hungrily.
"These bugs getting to me," Pan whispered.
All three of us scratched mercilessly at the chiggers that had embedded themselves under our skin. As the mosquitoes and biting flies bore down, Suki withdrew the animal bladder filled with thick bear grease.
"Whew! This got some smell to it,"
Pan whispered when she dipped the yellow grease out and silently showed him how to rub it on his face and exposed skin. At another time, the smell alone would have prevented me from using it, but when she offered some to me, I too used it liberally. When our faces and limbs shone from the thick ointment, Suki grunted and rose heavily, motioning for us to follow her across the shallow stream. Again, we fought through dense underbrush that tore at our clothing and at our skin until we made our way through to an opening on the other side. There, lit by the night, lay open fields of corn. Suki pointed into the distance, then firmly grasped my hand.
"Swamp," she scratched into my palm. "What'd she say?" Pan asked.
"She said that up ahead is the swamp," I said, squinting to better see the dark outline of tall trees.
"Are we almost home when we get to the swamp?" Pan asked.
"No," I said, and that silenced him again. There were some night hours remaining, ideal for traveling. But relieved to be this close to the swamp, and with the cover that the corn stalks would provide, I sank to the ground and declared that we would take a short rest. I had not slept since leaving the Spencer home, and I felt overcome from exhaustion. Suki, though, shook her head and motioned for us to continue on. I disregarded her and scraped together a bed of leaves for a pillow, and when I lay down, Pan followed suit. Finally, Suki, sighing heavily, did the same. Minutes later, all three of us were sound asleep. I awoke with the early morning sun in my face. I leaped up, startling the other two out of a sound sleep.
"We slept too long,"
Pan noted while Suki and I stared at each other, disbelieving the hour. I longed for a drink from the stream, but that would have meant backtracking, so I promised myself we would have water as soon as we reached the swamp. By my estimation, we were under 5 miles away, a destination that could be reached easily before noon. I looked out across the lonely cornfield. Seeing no humans about, I decided that we would take the same risk and travel during daylight. Again, Suki objected but followed when I scooped up my jacket and moved out. We had been moving swiftly for a good long while and had almost reached the outskirts of the swamp when a gunshot burst through the still air. Startled crows cawed and flew up as Suki and I flung ourselves to the ground, parallel to each other between the rows of corn. Pan, confused, stayed standing until I yanked him down behind me. When a crashing noise came toward us, Suki rose to her hands and knees, then lifted up her skirt and clamped it in her teeth as she began to crawl forward. I crawled too, with Pan close behind, until the gun blasted again. We all hit the ground just as a huge black bear crashed by in front of us, trailing blood. Though still a distance away, the sound of men's excited voices grew closer. We dared not move. Unexpectedly, the bear circled back toward the hunters. With whoops of surprise and a rifle report, their shouts receded and we rose again to our hands and knees. We scrambled until we reached the safety of the swamp, and there had to push through tangles of thick vines and briars before we were in far enough to hunker down. The ground we sat on was damp and sponge-like. The forest around us was so dense that it appeared black, but we had reached the great swamp. Gasping for air, we sat staring at one another, disbelieving that we had reached safety. We had only just caught our breath when we heard shouts, followed by more shots from a rifle. Now came the barking of dogs. As one, we scrambled to our feet to push farther in. With the sound of dogs sharp in the air, we tore our way through, deep into the tangled overgrowth and darkness until the sound of men and dogs began to fade. We dared not rest. I hated the way the soft, boggy land gave under my feet, But I hated even more stepping into the tea-colored water to weave our way knee-deep through the maze of jutting cedar roots that buckled up as twisted barriers. From above, thick corded vines netted with Spanish moss draped down to ensnare us. With each vine I pushed away, I thought of the cottonmouth moccasins, the copperheads, and the rattlesnakes known to inhabit the place. We struggled on, Pan surprisingly agile in water that was at times waist-deep. Suki suddenly grunted and pointed ahead to what appeared to be a small green island. Exhausted, we slogged toward it and finally onto the dry piece of land where, in the midst of towering white oak and green pine, there lay a massive overturned oak. The enormous root ball rose at least 6 feet into the air. After Suki cautiously pulled back the thick overgrowth of moss and vines covering it, she waved us over to show us a cave-like hideaway. We were peering into the dark interior when, from behind, something massive came barreling through the water. As one, we dove into the shelter, letting the heavy vines swing down behind us. The interior was dark, low, deep, and wide, and as the crashing sounds grew dim, I whispered in relief that it must have been the bear escaping the hunters. When Suki nodded agreement, she tapped my arm, and I gave her my palm. "Rest," she scratched, and then encircled her abdomen with her hands.
"What'd she say?" Pan asked, tightly clutching my arm. "She say something about her baby coming?"
"No, she wants to rest," I said.
"Good," he said. "I'm sure glad to hear there's no baby coming now."
I was on edge with the nearby hunters and would have pushed on through the swamp, but Suki lay back with a sigh. Pan did the same. I stayed sitting up, too uneasy to rest. I looked about the dark cave and worried what would come next. We had the patrollers pursuing us, and though it was not likely they would come this deep into the swamp, there was the danger of escaped slaves, men desperate enough to live in this ungodly habitat who did not welcome intruders. Finally, I lay back to close my eyes. But moments later, I was swatting frantically at a gigantic spider that had crawled onto my face. I sat up, shuddering, squinting in the dark to see where it had gone. Pan and Suki were resting, but I was overcome with the hopelessness of what lay ahead. Lost in this overgrown quagmire, we had to follow that cross-ditch on foot, traveling the 10 miles of rough towpath only at night, since barges would be coming through by day, no doubt some with patrollers eager for the large bounty. Then there was the danger of the animals. This huge swamp was known to shelter not only bear, of which we had evidence, but also other predatory animals such as wolves, panthers, and bobcats. Alligators lived here as well, but it was the snakes I feared the most. I had not yet told Suki that on our crawl for the swamp, I had lost our supply of bread and cheese. What, I wondered, would we do for food? Fortunately, the tea-colored water surrounding us was drinkable, and though we all had an earlier fill of it, I now slipped out for more. A wide shaft of light traveled down the incredible height of the trees. I might have seen a certain beauty in it had I not been so anxious. I went to the water's edge and knelt on a mass of ferns, there to cut my hands and slurp up the brown water. Then, as I splashed my face, Suki quietly joined me. She hunched down to drink, but when she leaned over, she gave a startled yelp. I sprang up, thinking she had seen something I had not. She avoided looking at me as she awkwardly rose to her feet, and I went cold when her hands gripped her swollen abdomen. Was it possible that she was ready to give birth? Pan suddenly emerged from the cave.
"Hey, Mr. Burton, you give me a scare," he said, rushing to my side. "I woke up and thought you went without me."
His eyes followed Suki walking heavily back toward the cave. She stopped at a nearby tree and broke off a small branch, about a foot long and 1 to 2 inches in diameter, and took it with her as she crawled into the cave.
Why did she want that stick? Did she mean to kill the child?
I had heard of Negroes doing things like that. Bile rose in me. What kind of mother would do that? I must leave now, without her. I sat arguing with myself while Pan squatted beside me, studying my face.
"You think she's gonna have that baby?" he asked. "Mr. Burton, what are we gonna do with a baby?"
I shook my head in response while trying to think clearly. From inside the cave came a sharp cry of pain. "Stay here," I said to Pan, then went back into the cave. Suki met me with a loud moan.
"Quiet!
You must be quiet!" I stared at her as my eyes adjusted to the dark.